From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon criticized Saudi Arabia and its allies Thursday for using undue pressure on him to remove them from a blacklist of violators of the rights of children. The Secretary General said at a press encounter at UN headquarters in New York that he decided to take Riyadh and its partners off the list for the Saudi killings of civilians in Yemen after they threatened to cut off funding to UN humanitarian programs, calling the move one of the most painful and difficult decisions he has had to make. Last week, the UN had blacklisted Saudi Arabia and its allies, saying they were responsible for 60% of the child deaths and injuries last year, which include more than 9,400 Yemenis who have lost their lives since Saudi Arabia began its invasion of that country in March of last year. This is the press conference that was held at the UN Thursday in its entirety.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. It's a great pleasure to see you all once again. Before I take your question, I'd like to highlight three challenges that affect the wide sweep of our work today. First, we need to keep up momentum on the development agenda and climate change. In April, a record number of member states signed the Paris Agreement on climate change. Now, we need to bring that agreement into force this year. I thank G7 leaders for committing to this goal. I welcome the announcement 2 days ago by Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India that he will join this effort. To help advance the process, I will convene an event during the September high-level week of the General Assembly for countries to deposit their instruments of ratification. The second challenge I would point to is the need to build on the progress of the World Humanitarian Summit, which was held in Istanbul, Turkey. The summit generated nearly 3,000 new commitments. Now we need those who attended and those who did not to follow through with robust leadership. Third, we must do more to resolve major threats to international peace and security. Ladies and gentlemen, let me say a few words about some situations which are taking place now. In Syria, as my special envoy, Stefan de Mistura, said this morning in Geneva, the time is not yet mature for a third round of talks. We don't want to have talks for the sake of talks. At the same time, I want to underline the great urgency of the deadline of early August set by the co-chairs of the International Syria Support Group, ISSG. We have to have at least the beginnings of a serious agreement by then. Without the political horizon and discussions on the transitions, a further escalation is all too likely. We need unhindered humanitarian access and increased protection of civilians. That is the norm and must not be a bargaining chip. Withholding humanitarian assistance to civilians in desperate need is a war crime. I also call for the release of prisoners and detainees, thousands of whom are held in utterly inhumane conditions. Hundreds of Syrians and other refugees and migrants continue to die in the Mediterranean while making perilous journeys out of war and persecution. I have listened to the stories, hopes, and fears of many refugees in recent months to understand this challenge based on their firsthand experience. Today, I'm announcing that I will visit the Greek island of Lesbos next week to assess the situation and to show my solidarity. As we formulate the global response to adopt at the September 19th high-level meeting on large scale of movements of refugees and migrants, I look forward to continuing to work with member states to meet this test of our common humanity. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to say a few words about Yemen. All parties to this conflict must do far more to protect civilians, uphold international humanitarian law, and find a political solution that will end the violence and destruction. My latest report on children and armed conflict has documented the harrowing situation of Yemen's children. There has been fierce reaction to my decision to temporarily remove the Saudi-led coalition countries from the report's annex. This was one of the most painful and difficult decisions I have had to make. The report describes horrors no child should have to face. At the same time, I also had to consider the very real prospect that millions of other children would suffer grievously if, as was suggested to me, countries would defund many UN programs. Children already at risk in Palestine, South Sudan, Syria, Yemen, and so many other places would fall further into despair. It is unacceptable for member states to exert undue pressure. Scrutiny is a natural and necessary part of the work of the United Nations. I stand by the report. We will assess the complaints that have been made, but the contents will not change. I fully understand the criticism, but I would also like to make a larger point that speaks to many political challenges we face. When UN peacekeepers come under physical attack, they deserve strong backing by the Security Council. When UN personnel are declared persona non grata simply for carrying out their jobs, they should be able to count on firm support from the member states. And when UN reports come under fire for raising difficult issues or documenting violations of law or human rights, member states should defend the mechanisms and mandates that they themselves have established. As the Secretariat carries forward the work that is entrusted to us, I count on member states to work constructively and maintain their commitment to the cause of this organization. I thank you very much. I'm ready to answer some questions.
Mr. Secretary General, thank you very much for this press briefing. This is Talal Hash from Al Arabiya. My question to you concerning the removal of the coalition from the blacklist, it's not about the essence of whether to add them or not. It's about the process. Last year, when you had Israel on the list, you have conducted talks and negotiations and dialogue with the Israelis and the Americans, and you took the name of Israel off before the report was published. In this case, you publish and then afterwards you remove the coalition from the blacklist. Doesn't this bring the image of double standards, and it actually tarnish the process in this international organization? Thank you so much.
In the course of making reports available to the member state, or in the course of preparing these reports, we have realized and observed that the countries were more concerned about that their country's name is listed together with some non-state actors like terrorist and extremist groups. Therefore, I think the main reaction of coalition is also that their names are included and together listed together with some terrorist and extremist groups. Therefore, we are now in the process of considering what would be the better modalities of listing those countries. For example, there may be a way to listing differently, you know, separately from non-state actors like terrorist groups and the countries, or we can just state and describe the situations as we have documented, as we have evidence, so let the member state judge. Those are not yet decided, but we will have to discuss this matter. Yeah, I have already. Yes, I have answered this process. This is one of the processes.
Thank you. Thanks, Dip. High Secretary General. My question is on South Sudan and the call that we've seen just this week from President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar that the international community drop its insistence of the International Tribunal or the AU's hybrid court for the sake of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, almost on the style that we saw in South Africa. What are your thoughts on this call that this international tribunal be taken away that was to try the atrocities that you've condemned so vociferously?
There are many aspects when it comes to South Sudan which we have to consider. For me, as for United Nations at this time, most important priority would be that the President Salva Kiir and the First Vice President Riek Machar, as a partner, as a leaders of South Sudan, should work together. I do not know how many times I have been meeting and telephoning them to urge them to get together and to establish a national government of unity. They have established this government of transitional government of unity. That's fine. Then now they should go beyond their own personal or whatever differences may be, perspectives may be, go beyond that and work for the country. There are so many people, millions of people have been suffering still. United Nations, we are now accommodating almost 200,000 refugees. UN missions have never been designed or never been prepared to accommodate so many refugees and displaced persons at this time. And therefore, there's a hugely serious humanitarian situation, very serious political instability. Then, of course, this accountability should, the process should also take place in due course or at the same time. And that's what I'm telling at this time.
James? A follow-up question on the Children in Armed Conflict report. You talk about undue pressure. The fact that you back down to that undue pressure, does that affect the credibility of the United Nations? And do you believe you were threatened by Saudi Arabia?
This is what I have been explaining at length during my remarks this morning. Many member states, when we make reports available publicly or in the process of making reports, a lot of complaints saying that those facts are not correct or exaggerated, etc., etc. But I have been making quite clear that our facts, the facts contained in the report, have been evidenced by many agencies, United Nations agencies present on the ground, and also many international humanitarian agencies working on the ground. Therefore, as I said, I stand by my report, but as how to present this report, particularly in listing, we will have to discuss this matter. And that's why I have accepted the proposal by Saudi Arabia to have some review on this matter. I invited them to come, and we will have discussion on this matter. And as I said again, this was a very difficult and painful decision I have to make because there are so many so many much more serious issues. Because of this, you cannot burn down whole house. I'm chief administrative officer of this organization. I have to take care and consider so many crises happening at the same time. While it was quite painful for me, or I accept all this criticism, that's a due criticism. The impression was not good one, as I understand. But despite all these kind of things, I had to make a decision just to keep all United Nations operations, particularly humanitarian operations, continue. Yeah.
Thank you very
much. Yeah. Okay. After your South Korea and Japan visit, there are many media, including South Korean media, are saying that you would run for presidential election of South Korea next year. So they are criticizing that you couldn't do your best, your duty as UN Secretary General, because of your interest in something like running for president next year after your term. What is your real mind related to that?
I and the spokesperson of the United Nations have answered these questions many times before. And those criticisms are unreasonable criticism. But I'd like to make one thing clear again today. As I have been for during last 9+ years, this is my last year as a Secretary General, I have made it quite clear on many occasions that I will never be distracted from my mandate as a Secretary General of the United Nations, entrusted by the member states. I will exert all my efforts and time as a Secretary General of the United Nations until the very last minute of my mandate. That's my answer, and this is my firm conviction. Thank you.
Mr. Secretary General, you said in your opening statement that withholding humanitarian assistance to civilians in desperate need is a war crime in Syria. Do you consider that airdrops should start, and what can you do to push for it?
Airdrops have always been on our consideration, and in fact, many airdrops have been made. But it cannot be a substitute to land deliveries. Land deliveries are most sure, and that's most convenient and speedier one. But because of very dire security, very dangerous security situations, and many roadblocks and very cumbersome administrative bureaucracies, we have not been able to deliver these humanitarian aids to many people, millions of people in besieged areas or hard-to-reach areas. Now, I'm encouraged that recently the Syrian government has allowed to have 23 land deliveries out of 34 requests. But we have sent back our request to the Syrian government that all 34 requests for land delivery should be granted. We are now negotiating with them. At the same time, airdrops is always on our option. Airdrops is easy to tell you, but it's very difficult. It is, first of all, you have to make sure that the aircraft or crews who are engaged in these airdrops, their safety and security should be guaranteed. And there should be a clear understanding and assurances from the Syrian government. And it has to be done at a very high altitude, around 7,000 meters high. So it is affected easily by wind and weather, and sometimes we cannot assure that these airdrops pellets, you know, coming down by all these parachutes, it's very difficult to make them land at the designated targeted area. So in any way, We are very seriously considering, together with the land deliveries and airdrops.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And now a special treat. BlackAgendaReport.com's Glenn Ford caught up with former Representative Cynthia McKinney, the 2008 Green Party presidential candidate, to discuss this year's presidential election.
This is a situation I believe that political scientists are going to be writing about and studying about for a very long time. And of this very important political moment, basically the idea that I have is that Black voters, I don't know a nice way to say that honestly we don't have any stake at all in the continuation of either the Democrat or Republican parties as they are currently constituted. And so the implosion of the duopoly, as you put it, is something that I believe is of great political import to the Black community. The problem is, however, that we have got to be organized in order to have an imprint on what is produced in the outcome, how those ashes, as they might be, get reconstituted into a political system that is befitting of our community and all of the communities within the United States of America. The United States itself is on a huge path of change, and it could go way or the other. And we have seen the dissolution of the Bill of Rights, such as it was for Blacks in the United States. And even that has been ripped to shreds. And we've got a surveillance state that puts COINTELPRO to shame. Now all communities are being subjected to the likes of a COINTELPRO, a counterintelligence program. And so, therefore, the United States is substantively changing. How we can impede the negatives of that change and propel the positives of that change are what are consuming my thoughts at the moment.
Paul Street says Democrats under Clinton are well underway to becoming the most pure expression of the ruling class in the United States.
And that is why many Republican establishment figures are fleeing to Hillary Clinton, which tells us about the state of the Democratic Party as an alternative. It never really was an alternative. It was an alternative only in the minds of the voters who were tricked and fooled and bamboozled into thinking that if they cast a vote for a candidate that had a D behind their name, that they were actually voting for a different policy. And so whether it was war policy, Wall Street policy, or domestic policy for that matter, treatment of African American community, there was huge consensus within the two, that duopoly, on how we were to be treated. And now, of course, that consensus has spread throughout both political parties such that Democrats were aware of the surveillance state that the United States had become, but they didn't fight against it either. And instead, out of the mouth of a Donald Trump, you get the Europeans need to pay for NATO. Look right now at the saber rattling that the U.S. political elite are doing against Russia and China. Instead of reaching out to Russia and China, the United States is using our tax dollars to threaten China in the South China Sea and at the front door threshold of Russia in Ukraine. So the duopoly elite have, I believe, reneged on their, maybe they're just demonstrating that they never really had a commitment to protecting the people of the United States. And so now I believe that the fractures inside the Republican Party, as well as the fractures inside the Democratic Party, have come to the forefront. And the things that I have spoken about, campaigned against, criticized, introduced legislation to change, now everybody sees, for example, how the pernicious effect of these superdelegates and how the will of the people can be stolen in the so-called democracy, and the will of the people no longer be reflected inside the democratic process. It has made the state of democracy in the United States a farce. And it's a farce that the rest of the world is looking at. But I hope it's a farce that, most importantly, the people inside the United States are learning that their system never really intended to represent them anyway.
Could we see the two-party duopoly system being replaced by maybe a multi-party system, three or four major parties vying for voters in this country?
There are many different theories about what could come next or what should come next. And we have seen that when we have this representative form of government, I don't want to get too theoretical here, but the representative form of government, basically, we, the people who have the power in a democracy, give our power over to people. And then we go to those very same people that we have given our power to, and we beg them to enact policy that makes sense to us. Well, that system doesn't make sense in the first place. That is indirect democracy. And so what the Jamahiriya in Libya was experimenting with was the same kind of democracy that exists in Switzerland, and that's direct democracy, where the people themselves make the policy and the people themselves decide what is best for them without handing over their policy making power to a set of people who become distanced from them. So there's the abandonment of the current kind of democracy that we have. There are tweaks that we can make inside the system that we have now. For example, I introduced a long time ago, when I was in the Congress, I introduced the Voters' Choice Act, which would have repealed the single member district and allowed for proportional representation. And what that means is that there would not be a winner-take-all system. We would have more of a system of power sharing that also allowed for the existence of more political parties, as you initially stated. So a combination of a change in the system of our voting and the winner-take-all character of it that we have in the U.S., along with a proliferation of parties, would allow us to have more representation. Because ultimately, what we are doing now is we're going through the motions of electing a representative, as I have said too many times. It makes me sick to say it again. But we have a representative and we have no representation. The whole point of an indirect democratic system is that the people supposedly have representation and that their ideas and their values have representation. That is something that, because of the pernicious effects of money, that's another tweak to the system that needs to be changed, is that we need to have public financing of elections. There needs to be giving the airwaves during political campaigns back to the people. This is another point that Trump brought out. There's a tremendous amount of money that these broadcasters are making on the citizens' right to know for whom they are going to cast their vote. And that makes no sense at all, because the system has become basically a closed loop where, in order to enter, it takes a lot of money. In order to stay, it takes even more money. And much of that money is spent on the media, buying ads 30 seconds at a time, when the most effective way, why should CNN and Fox and all of the rest of them make money? Because they are airing debates that every candidate should be involved in anyway.
That's it. Thanks for listening.